And say it's time to bring in David Tarachuk. It's time for the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday. Of course, David has his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And for the past several weeks, he has been in the great state of Maine. We'll see if he's back in the media capital of the world. Good morning.
Well, hello. I'm glad to be reporting again from Maine. Yes, getting close to the end of my assignment away from the media capital of the world, New York City. We're on my way back there eventually, I promise you. And I'm glad to be comparing notes yet again this week with the incisive Marshall Meyer.
You know, we'll get to the one factor that always seems to pop up, and that is Donald Trump. But before we get there, I'm interested in your coverage. Joe Biden has taken a lot of heat over the about a month ago, and are you still there, David? David, are you still there? Nope. I thought that he dropped out, so we'll just do this again. What more can you do? Give him a call back. Can hear those different. You just know when you lost somebody.
I think we're reconnected. Just to pick up again, Marshall. Are you hearing me now?
Yeah, I'm hearing you now. You know, I was bringing up it. I just don't think the Media Beat is covering enough. Now, I'm not talking about whether you like what Joe Biden has done as president, or whether you don't like what Joe Biden has done in president. That's not what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is the fact that, gosh, you know, for a first-term president with a 50-50 Senate, with a small, slim majority in the House, he has gotten now, with this latest step with student debt, he has got most, if not all, or portions of what he promised out on the campaign trail done. And I can tell you what, I can't remember back to a first-term president that has gotten as much accomplished.
Well, yeah, and that has dominated the week's news. You're quite right. It's the domestic news. Anyway, we'll go on to the international scene in a moment, I hope. But the Biden administration's plan for alleviating that extraordinary nationwide burden of student debt is remarkable. He's not, of course, the plans don't eliminate the debt entirely, or it's not being forgiven either. That's a very strange phrase, but the media's full of it this week. It's always struck me as a strange phrase for this essentially economic problem, as if somehow debt was a moral offense of some kind that needs forgiving. But the sheer size of the assistance on offer is undoubtedly substantial. And as you rightly say, in line with how candidate Joe Biden promised it might be when he was campaigning for the presidency. It was not as big, for instance, as Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders wanted. Senator Warren, for instance, has wanted all along a much bigger relief package, and she's been busily pressing the president along those lines right up until the announcement notice, the announcement of the actual plan came. But yesterday after it came, she was careful to tell all the journalists who wanted to know that she's in a celebratory mood about what has been decided by the White House, and as you say, against the background of midway through, just as the midterms arrive in a president's first term, usually or very often in history, as you pointed out, a time when the president is usually in the doldrums. This seems to be a recurring pattern. Halfway through first term, he's always up against a lot of dissent. And of course, as we know, the Congress is finely balanced, and it's very prone to logjam. But this is a substantial piece of policy advance. And, you know, it's brought us some good journalism, too. I hope we've got the fanfare available, because I think a fanfare this week should go to some good journalism that's been measuring this loan relief plan's impact on the ground. Could you hear it, do you think?
We do have the fanfare available.
That's good to hear. The fanfare goes to the leading newspaper of this state that I'm reporting from, Maine. The Portland Press Herald deserves our applause for the way it did what regional journalists are meant to do, provide a genuinely local take close to the reader's interests on a major national story. So that was how... staff writer Peter Hui is the name of the journalist responsible. It's how he set about assessing how Maine's borrowers, student loan borrowers, will be affected. Many thousands of them, in fact. His sources led him to conclude that 177,000 borrowers in Maine will be benefiting from the Biden plan. And early evidence in the field suggests that the focusing of the aid that's built into this plan, concentrating it on those with the least resources, will effectively serve this section of the Maine's population, particularly absolutely those who need it most are the ones who are going to benefit, and individual Mainers who Hoey singled out ranged from a 66-year-old woman who incurred debt. Up to more than 80,000 in order to get her undergraduate and her master's degree. And she's very grateful to have it diminished a bit, but substantially. And how he worked all the way through to younger people whose debts tend to be, in general, smaller than that 80,000. And they're having their debts wiped out entirely, many of them. A 26-year-old recent graduate who will qualify for the full $20,000 available for relief, and she and her fiancé will now be able to get married. This is basic, very basic, human-centered journalism, giving us the human face of a story. I was very glad to read it, it wasn't all just vox pop, you know, vox populi, voice of the people. There was some very good analytical work around this from Hoey. Let me quote something from the nonpartisan Maine Center for Economic Policy that Hoey went to for, you know, as a source for analysis. The quote goes like this: This federal action to forgive student loans particularly benefits Mainers who hold more student debt than the average American. That was something I didn't know until I was on this assignment this year to Maine. It's a message, this whole story is a message from one state, just one state, and perhaps one more affected than many. But it has relevance to us all, and I'm glad to mark a good piece of Maine journalism about this topic. And of course, the whole subject is party politically contentious, of course. I mean, what isn't in America these days? But there's also some rippling of technocratic economists' disputation, even inside parties, on the issue of whether or not pouring an estimated $500 billion of taxpayers' money into the economy will generate greater inflation. It's notable that Democratic economic experts, or some anyway, are claiming that it will. On the other hand, others are saying no, and the journalism reflects that too, pointing out that clearing people's oppressive debt is hardly going to make people rush out and spend money in a frenzy of demand that sends retail prices soaring. But of course, as ever, with economics, you cannot tell for sure in advance. We'll have to wait and see.
All right, we can move on from that, and we'll just slightly before we go international, bring up today's the day at noontime is when the judge has ordered the government to release the redacted documents from Mar-a-Lago.
Sure, this, it's good news for news, for the news organizations, in particular CNN, Washington Post, Scripps. They're the ones who've been pressing, for a full revelation of the Department of Justice's and the FBI's reasoning behind the Mar-a-Lago search warrant that was executed just recently in relation to those confidential government papers that ex-President Trump took away from the White House. Well, the same federal judge who approved the warrant has decided, I guess in favor of the media, that it can be revealed, but not all of it. A redacted version of the so-called affidavit that lay behind the warrant application was prepared, as they were ordered to do it. The DOJ and the FBI worked together to prepare it and presented it to the federal judge. Judge Magistrate Bruce Reinhardt, even though they did so a little unwillingly, since the law enforcement people still don't want it published at all, really. But Judge Reinhardt seemed to give some indication over the course of this last week of the way that he would finally decide when he wrote that redactions, when they're made, might amount to so many of those bold black lines through the text that it would make the whole thing indecipherable. But anyway, whatever he may have feared about that, he decided that the redacted version can go public. And as you say, 4 hours from now, it will be made public far at a time. And then journalists will see just how decipherable or indecipherable it is. I think guidance as to what the law enforcement people were actually thinking and what they based their conviction that a search warrant was necessary, what they were basing that conviction on, might be something that can be gleaned by practiced legal observers and court reporters who've been into this kind of territory before, but never quite specifically on such a scale like this of a former president playing fast and loose with top secret papers. Maybe they'll be able to sniff out what is the thinking behind this effort to reclaim the government papers from Trump. And then perhaps we will see whether or not there is enough eventually we'll get to know whether there's enough evidence there to justify any kind of legal action, even of a criminal kind, against the former president.
By releasing the redacted documents in full, I think that there's a lot of people who have worked for foreign intelligence for this country in the intelligence community can offer a broad insight. What releasing all these documents, even though they're redacted, will do, you'll get a general oversight as to what portion of America's secrets in what direction in general Donald Trump was for some reason keeping for himself, maybe for future publication. But you'll get an idea about how serious of a problem this is.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not so sure. And trying to work out what the motivations of the former president might have been is a kind of a loser's game, it seems to me. It can, we in a way, we know this man. And I think some of the wisest and best informed journalists about Trump, I'm thinking particularly of Maggie Haberman from the New York Times, they've been pondering this for some time, and they have many years' experience. And if, like some of us, you may have been in New York when Trump was a real estate mogul hogging as much publicity he could get, and cultivating journalists all the time, back through, you know, from the 1980s through to the 2010s, you'll know that there's something about Trump that could boil down to something as simple as he wanted these trophies. He's a man about trophies, and he wanted to hold on to things that for him had a glint of the gold about them. It may be something as simple and as childish, I suppose, that might lie behind it. Or, you know, as you're suggesting, there may have been something really genuinely motivational about it. There was some purpose to it. But I wouldn't be surprised to find out that it had no great strategic thinking behind it. Much of what Trump does often has no strategic thinking behind it. But we'll see. It was interesting to note, and one of the less edifying moments of media interaction this week, to see the former president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who's got a memoir to promote, to see him promoting that memoir on Fox and Friends. And of course, as we know, Fox News has proven to be something of a disappointment to the former president. But generally speaking, it's always been a very friendly environment for Trump and Trump senior supporters, including his family, to appear on. And in general, it was a very affable kind of combination, except that even Steve Doocy, who's, the ringleader of Trump support in the Fox and Friends team, had the extraordinary nerve, in the circumstances, I suppose, to ask Kushner a serious question. It was just, why would your father-in-law want all those top-secret documents in Mar-a-Lago? And Jared Kushner had no real answer. All he had to say was that he had no idea, he had no information about what was in those documents or why the president wanted to keep them. It may be. I'm going to stop speculating now. It's almost pointless to try and figure out what goes on in the Trump mind.
Well, I'll say now what I said when he was elected. You elected a man who basically for his whole life has been his own boss, answering to no one but himself. And as president, he continued on acting like he did beforehand, and leaving the office, he took what he thought was rightfully his, whether it was or not, because he's never had any boundaries placed on him as a leader of a business. And the old thing, you know, a rose is a rose is a rose.
Sure. I'd suggest that there was a period of his life when he did answer to someone, and that, of course, was his father, who was an extraordinary bully. We can read into that whatever we want to read into that. He's not a man accustomed at all to any kind of guardrails upon his behavior. And the American Constitution is, as is often said, a mass of guardrails to prevent tyrannical or megalomaniac behavior in our leaders. We'll see how this particular issue plays out. It's an interesting one because, after all, how many presidents in history have had their private residences raided by law enforcement after they leave office? It's undoubtedly a singular story for the press to be following. Let's take a look internationally,
yes,
shall we?
Absolutely.
Because, as you know, it has dominated the week's news too. Huh?
Yeah, where do you want to start? There's so many international stories.
I've got the calendar in front of me, and as every journalist always does, and the calendar dictates a lot in the world of journalism. The passing of a full 6 months of the war following Russia's unprovoked invasion in February into Ukraine. It occurred this week, and it was just when the war-torn country was celebrating, though that's not the right word, of course, Independence Day, 31 years of independence from Russia since Ukraine broke away from the then crumbling Soviet Union back in 1991. 24th of August is the day. News media had no big celebratory events to report on since low-key was the government, the Ukrainian government's order of the day, the Independence Day, hoping that any such events would not present a tempting target for the Russians to attack in some spectacular, terrifying fashion. But even so, the day was marked with yet another Russian atrocity, a missile attack on a train station in the Dnipro region, killing between 20 and 30 people, with the number horribly likely to increase, of course, since there were many more wounded, some of them critically. A passenger train appeared to suffer a direct hit, with four rail cars crushed and blazing on fire. You'll have seen the horrific imagery of that, spread across mainstream and social media. Well, the President Zelensky, gave an Independence Day address, of course, but it wasn't directly to his own people. Instead, he was addressing the United Nations Security Council in New York via remote video, of course. He made an independence-related point, I think, speaking to the diplomats there. It's worth noting now, let me quote him, Ukraine is a nation reborn in conflict with a renewed sense of cultural and political identity, wholly separate from Russia, probably now as never before, we might say. And just to underline what direction much of the West wants Ukraine to keep turned toward, the U.S. government chose Ukraine's Independence Day as well to confirm another large swath, this time $3 billion worth of American weapons and equipment being sent to Ukraine, the biggest piece of U.S. security assistance to be given so far. And it's all, it's carefully phrased what this is. It's to support self-defense, the usual phrasing of the Pentagon and the State Department spokespeople.
You know, when something was put in a headline, and I don't think Americans really realize this, and it was a story with the BBC stating this very quite simple fact. It was the anniversary of the war between the two biggest states in the European Union. I don't think people realize how important and how big Ukraine is, and really you do realize how large the Soviet Union is, Russia is, even though they're not as large as they used to be. But what's going on between Ukraine and Russia is so big, and it's so important to so many different aspects of not only the European Union's economy, but the rest of the world's economy as well.
Sure. As we know, Russia and Ukraine had something in common as having a large swaths of the territory in that Eastern Europe, southern stretches of that part of the continent known as the steppes, STEPPES. Prairie land, really, in many ways, those steppes have traditionally fed the world, wheat especially, but other agricultural products too. And of course, their supply now terribly interrupted by the war. Although there's been some effort, one of the only pieces of diplomatic rapprochement between the two countries that have happened has meant that some supply ships have been able to get out of the Black Sea and out into the oceans of the world to deliver again grain that the much of the poorer world has been totally reliant upon for decades now. Yes, the economic implications of this war stretch beyond, a former member of the Soviet Union being invaded by the main country in that former Soviet Union, Russia itself. Though that simple though horrific limited nature of the conflict is enough to make it huge in its implications. It was in some ways inevitable. Just look at the kind of regime that Putin has presided over, and the philosophy behind it, which is that Russia has to regain its position in the world as something of an empire. There is much imperial thinking going on behind this invasion. And one of its ideologues, of course, seemed to be attacked this week, though in fact it was his daughter who was blown up in a car bomb inside Russia. It's Russia proper. And that's some indication of what the stakes are for the former Soviet Union countries involved. But as you say, it has huge significance for the world at large. And if you're in Europe, as I have been, during the past, it's extraordinary to see how, in many ways, this is the biggest war that's gone on since the Second World War. It's a very big and important subject indeed.
And by mentioning that, David, it once again, you take a step back and look and see how ahead of its time and how advanced and how lucky we are that NATO is still together, because it would be a whole different scene if NATO hadn't been around for the past 50 years, whatever, and Russia. This very well could have led to a world war.
And it's interesting to reflect that, NATO remained intact after its main reason for existence. Its essential raison d'etre was to oppose the Soviet Union, but it stayed intact after the Soviet Union collapsed. And indeed, it's interesting to see that given the kind of Russia that developed in the post-Soviet years, under first of all the craziness, economic craziness, especially of the Yeltsin years, followed by the entrenchment of Putin as president, with this imperial vision that seems to underlie it all. Given all of that, what happened to NATO during that time is that it expanded. And in some ways, it's easy to see that was necessary. Hindsight is bearing this out now, that we have a development in which NATO may have played its role as something of a provocateur, in that it grew and appeared even more frightening to the former Soviet Union's leaders, Putin himself in particular, than was really intended. But as you say, it's a substantial block in a defensive nature now against the kind of behavior that I think all the time strategic thinkers were concerned about with an imperialistically minded Russia.
David, it's always great to speak to you. We'll see what happens in the next week.
Talk to you next week.
Take care. David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com on the web.